Good evening, everyone. Still so strange to be talking to faces on a screen, but I know you're really there on the other side of these digits or bytes or bits or whatever they are. I think I want to say at the outset that what Oscar is working on the this climate emergency plan is very important for our county, for the world. You know, a lot of action on this has been taking place locally rather than, you know, at a national scale. We have some hope now maybe that there will be more initiatives at the national scale, but a lot of work is being done at the local scale. And what Oscar has been working on in his organization, 350.org, is really an important piece of that. So I encourage everyone to consider making a comment to the Sacramento County Board of Supervisors for this Wednesday's meeting. And I also want to acknowledge this day. It's quite a day. It's so much happening, and it's such a fraught time. I mean, just today, we passed 300,000 deaths from COVID-19 in the United States. And it's just an unbelievable number. And when you think about all the families and, you know, friends and people that are affected by those, that have been affected by those deaths, it just staggers the mind. And, you know, if we were meeting in person, we would do well-being ceremony, but it's kind of hard to do it on this format. We should try doing it anyway soon. But just feeling the suffering that is, you know, in our country and in this world. As we, you know, approach the end of this year. And at the same time, today we saw a tiny bit of light, you know, come with the administration of the first vaccines, the first shots administered to healthcare workers in all around the country. And I believe in Sacramento here, if not today, tomorrow. So, you know, we've got this, you know, we can see that there's a path out of this, but it's still, you know, we all know it's a long way to go. And it's a dark time as we reach the darkest days of the year. And also today, you know, I think they settled the presidential election once and for all. So we know, we knew before, but now we know, and everybody knows, and nobody can deny that the election is settled and over. And so hopefully that part of our national bad dream is also showing a little bit of light or resolution. It's just such a time. I've never lived through a time like this, I don't think, in my life. And I've lived through the Vietnam War and some terrible things, but the way this has been sustained and how close to home it's been is really different. And I'm thinking tonight, you know, how lucky we are to have a Sangha to have, you know, the refuge of Sangha, of Buddha and Dharma. And so tonight I wanted to talk about, well, I wanted to start kind of with a dream that I thought was about Sangha. I had a dream, and then I just wanted to have some reflections back on our sesshin that we just did. And whether you sat the sesshin or not, it's not just for people who sat the sesshin. It will be something that hopefully everybody can find something in. But so this dream, actually, I had this dream quite some time ago when I was in individual counseling with a Zen priest who, after 20 years of practice or more, was getting his marriage and family counselor license. And when I was meeting with him, I had a dream that we were standing together and we were looking at this wall. And this wall was really, really beautiful, but I can't really describe it, but the impression of the wall was really, really beautiful. And but the important thing about the dream seemed to me to be that he and I, together, standing side by side, were facing this wall and appreciating this wall and receiving some gift that I don't know what it was, but it felt like we were receiving some gift from this wall, this beautiful wall that we were facing. The thing that was really important to me about that dream was not the wall or what it meant or what it symbolized or anything like that. It was the fact that my therapist, priest, friend, and I were standing side by side. And I think this is, this to me, this is what this represents, is companionship on the way. And I think it's such an important aspect of our practice of Sangha, companionship on the way, facing the wall together. Of course, we actually, in this tradition, classically speaking, have a practice of facing walls, now we are not doing that, and we're facing the screen, and we're facing each other on the screen, which is a kind of wall, I guess, but a little different. I should have had some hot tea tonight. I don't feel like my voice is quite what I want it to be, but nevertheless. So anyway, as I mentioned, we were doing this. We had a sesshin, and we were facing the screen. We actually, each day for a certain amount of time over, 7 days, we came to this screen, and we faced the screen, and we sat meditation in the mornings and the evenings for the first 5 days. And then on the sixth day, we sat a long full day from 6 a.m. until 9 at night. And there were some people doing this sesshin who were doing it for the first time. They had never... This was their introduction to sitting a sesshin, was sitting on this computer system, sitting a sesshin. So that was quite a challenge, to have that be your first sesshin and do it facing, a screen, rather than being in a room with other people who are making the endeavor of the way with you. You didn't have that same quite that feeling of companionship. that feeling of you know, making an effort together. And some people reported, especially these people that was the first time that they were sitting, they said, you know, that was hard. That was way harder than I expect. I really wasn't expecting it to be that hard. And it was hard physically. It was hard mentally. And I didn't know if I was going to make it. I didn't know if I could, you know, really get through. I guess in a certain way, I think I should apologize for not telling new people this is going to be hard to do. You know, Sesshin is a hard thing to do. And I thought it was kind of a relaxed schedule from what I'm used to doing Sesshin, but still, I should have, in my promotion, I neglected to mention that this can be a hard thing to stick with, a hard thing to I could mention in this regard my first Sesshin. My first Sesshin was quite a long time ago, but it was just as it was for those who found this difficult. That Sesshin was really, really, really difficult for me. And I sat, it was a traditional Sesshin with other people sitting beside me, a lot of people sitting in a Zendo together. And it was 7 days, and it was from, I don't know, 5 in the morning until 9 at night each day. So, and about 14 periods every day. And that's kind of a traditional Japanese style Sesshin. And at that time, I'd never done anything like that. I'd set a couple of one day sittings, and then I came to that. And it was really the hardest thing that I've ever done in my life. It nearly defeated me, and it kind of broke me down, and it was almost more than I could do. And I never really thought about leaving. I thought, I'm stuck, and I just have to stay here. And I don't know, that's my lack of imagination, I guess. Not being smart enough to think I could just, you know, walk out of here. I could just walk away. But I didn't do that. I was with some friends, maybe that was it. And I thought, well, they're doing it and they're not walking away, so I'm not going to either. But it was very, very difficult. And I ended the Sesshin in the room that I was staying in the arms of a friend of mine, lying on the floor, just crying my eyes out. That was a relief. That was a relief cry, right? It was over. But it was hard, very, very difficult to do. So why do we do this? Why do we do this thing that's so hard? And part of it is just because it demands something from us that if we weren't put in that kind of pressure cooker, we would never do on our own. You know, it demands something of us way beyond what we, you know, the kind of practice that we would probably do, you know, without that container, without that structure. And it calls forth something from us to meet it, some energy, some determination, maybe it just shows how stupid we are. I don't know, to continue, but we do. Because it calls on something in us that wants to meet it. And you know, it's the kind of, I guess you could say, you could call it kind of a, especially your first one, you could call kind of an initiatory experience, kind of an initiation. But it's not the kind of initiation that some places, you know, have, like they hurt you, or they, you know, other people, like, you know, put you through the ringer in some sort of way. You put yourself through the ringer. And, but what is different about Sesshin is that something comes to meet you to help you do it. Some energy in the mind of Zazen, you know, and the physical determination or fortitude of Zazen comes to meet you as you do it. And it's only by that being met, you know, that you are able to do Sesshin. And when you're first, you know, when it's your first Sesshin, maybe, you know, you're not so aware of what's coming to meet you. You know, you're more aware of, like, your effort to do it. And so it, you know, it's, that's why we, you know, that's why I signed up for the second Sesshin after I did the first one that I ended up on the floor crying about. You know, why did I sign up for another one? But I did. You know, so because I saw that something came to meet me. And what was coming to meet me, I thought I needed, you know, I wanted whatever it was, that energy, that determination, that, and also that that kind of peace, that feeling of peace that came through all of the effort, all of the struggle, all of the difficult, the physical pain, actually, you know, physical pain of sitting cross-legged for period after period. No small thing. So in our Sesshin just passed, just that just happened, somebody brought up the fact that in one of our, I don't know, discussions or questions or something like that, someone brought up the fact that they started sitting or felt attracted to practice because they became aware of how impacted they were by their internal dialogue, by the ruminations or the constant verbalization in their minds. And I took it that this person could see that the kind of repetition that was going on in the internal dialogue, the kind of, and that it was kind of a driven type of repetition, maybe the same thoughts over and over again. This is characteristic of an internal dialogue telling stories that have quite a resemblance to each other, over and over again about other people, about circumstances. And, you know, so becoming aware of that internal dialogue, there arose, I guess, simultaneously some kind of idea or thought that what would it be like if I didn't, you know, what would it be like without this? Or what would it be like if there was some quiet? If there was a little bit more space, maybe, instead of all this kind of constant racket of internal verbalizations. So, you know, this is a perfectly good reason to come to start practice. And one understanding we could have about what would happen if we started to practice, one understanding would be that we would think, if I do this sitting meditation, you could have this expectation that this dialogue, this internal conversation, is going to quiet down, and you wouldn't be wrong about that. You wouldn't be misapprehending the possibility of what could result in engaging the way in Zazen. Engaging in the way in Zazen, indeed, it may come to pass that through a physical stillness and upright posture, the mind will still also. The mind will go along with the stillness of the posture, and that you will be able to enter that stillness and abide in that stillness and gain a different perspective on your life from the perspective of that stillness. You wouldn't be wrong to think that that is going to be an outcome of a sitting meditation practice. Hopefully that actually sounds familiar to most of you. That sounds a little familiar. Like, I sat still, and I sat still again, and I sat still again, and I noticed that my mind grew quiet, and there wasn't so much chatter, and I could apprehend things a little differently. I could see things with a little less coloring by me, a little less coloring of my preconceptions. My preconceptions, my prejudices, my prejudgments, my karmic habits, whatever you want to call it. You see a little less coloring of things, and you feel encouraged by that. But I wouldn't want to say that actually that you should set up some kind of goal, or you know, or you should judge your practice by how quiet you get, you know. I don't think that would be quite right. Because the other way, you know, there's something else about your internal dialogue, and that's transforming your internal dialogue. Transforming seeing that you're the tone, the character of your internal dialogue changes or becomes more, changes its character. And sometimes, you know, my teacher talks about that practice, our practice is a conversation. And one way to characterize that conversation is as a conversation between the enlightened one or Buddha and a sentient being or you. So it's possible that this internal conversation changes a bit and your understanding of it changes a bit. And you see that, yes, there is still an internal conversation or there's still an internal dialogue going on. But now there's a person, there's a part of you that is kind of can get into this idea of stillness, can get into this idea of peace, and you want to, and there's some intention in your life then that grows that wants to move in that direction. But at the same time, you don't have to squash, you know, the side of you that has ideas and is creative and is, you know, made energetic, right? So that, because that side's always going to be there. You're not just a, what was that lawyer say in the Watergate? I'm not a potted plant. I think that's too old for some of you. But anyway, there was a lawyer and he said, "Sir, I'm not a potted plant." when he wanted to speak, and I guess the other person with more power didn't want him to speak. So you're not a potted plant sitting zazen, you know, that's not the point. Your point isn't to turn you into a potted plant, but some dialogue in or conversation is still happening in zazen, and but it's an informed dialogue, and it's and that, you know, there it goes back and forth both ways. So you know, Buddha is saying to some of the stuff that you're bringing up, no, not now. That really isn't. You really don't need to bring that up right now. And that's for later. You really need to like let that go right now. But some other things that come up, maybe in the form of an insight, and you may work with that a little bit in your zazen. You may work with something that comes up, and it's still in the form of a thought, just like, you know, your other internal combustions, but it's on the subject. It's on the subject, right? Of what you're going for, what your intention is, how your life wants to unfold. So you entertain that and you have some dialogue. And so zazen is about being discriminating, you know, and it actually is true that about 90% of what comes up, you can just let go. And then there's about 10% maybe that you work with in your sitting. But you don't have to become a potted plant. But if you want to sit in absolute stillness and peace and silence and no thought, please, please go ahead. That's really okay. And some of that is really good for you. And so in Sesshin, you know, we get some of this really good for us stuff. No thinking, just sitting, just in peace, letting go of everything. That's an okay time. Well, I had some notes here, but I don't know if I, oh, I don't know if I need to bring that up. What time is it getting to be? Oh, I think I'm going to wrap this up and we can have some questions. But I did want to bring up, something. I was the person leading the sesshin, and the person leading the sesshin has a great deal, you know, of responsibility. You really, I mean, I've sat a lot of sesshins, and I've, you know, always, you know, the person who's leading the sesshin is really important, because you're kind of, you know, you need something, you know, they provide some support, you know, ideally. They provide some support and help us sustain our efforts during the sesshin. And in our recent sesshin, I had an experience of failing to meet my responsibility to support everyone. And I made an unwarranted assumption about one of the people sitting the sesshin. And I failed to practice kind speech. And when I realized my error, it was quite devastating. And I was almost frozen for a bit of time. And then I realized the only thing I could do was to apologize and confess my shame and embarrassment at having made this wrong assumption, almost a false accusation to a person sitting the sesshin. So, you know, this is for in Zen, you know, and especially for a priest, we live by vow. This is how we live, by vow. And we teach by example, by setting an example. That's what we are meant to do. That's what our vocation is. And when we fail to act in accord with our vow, the only thing left to do is confess remorse and regret. And we do that, and then we go back to remembering our vow and upholding our vow. And the other thing that's really important, and this applies to everyone, I think, is when we make a mistake, we don't dwell on it or carry on too overly long beating ourselves up about it. This is very important. We confess our remorse and our regret. We reaffirm our vow. We make sure, in my case, make sure a person that I insulted, we have some further discussion, and then let go. And that's the atmosphere of practicing together. That's, I think, the atmosphere of practice. We're going to make mistakes. And I'm actually kind of glad I made a mistake and like that. And because I don't want to ever be held up as some kind of perfect person or perfect teacher or anything like that in this group. That would be kind of awful for me. So stumbling badly in front of everyone was good medicine for me. And Dogen thinks that stumbling badly is just fine And he has this wonderful quote that I'm going to end with tonight from Guidelines for Studying the Way. And this is his words. For those who are immersed in the way, all traces of enlightenment perish. Those who practice the Buddha way should first of all trust in the Buddha way. Those who trust in the Buddha way should trust that they are in essence within the Buddha way, where there is no delusion, no false thinking, no confusion, no increase or decrease, and no mistake. To arouse such trust and illuminate the way in this manner and to practice accordingly are fundamental in studying the way. So thank you very much. We want to raise some hands or make some comments, I see Barry, yes?
Your comment about what transpired at the Sesshin, it really makes me, illuminates to me kind of the difference between the tradition we built here and more traditional Japanese tradition. Because, I think a lot of us have read that Eat, Sleep, Sit. Is that what that book's called?
Yeah, Eat, Sleep,
yeah.
Sit.
Yeah, I mean, those poor guys are just terrorized by the elders. And even when, I think I told you this story, Jim, before, I sat a Sesshin at a Rinzai monastery and like half, my first day at the Sesshin was kind of a rough one for me. So I was like, the next morning, I was just kind of like barely hanging on. And during the morning, they call it Choka, the morning sutras. Like the Rinzai monasteries, they do the sutras before the first sitting in the morning. Halfway through, the priest stops it to yell at me for doing it wrong in front of everyone, just like berates me for like 5 minutes, and then goes on. It just really hit home. Like what you did is so mild compared to stuff I've seen. I don't really have a point other than it's just kind of interesting, just the different, I think it just shows us a more loving, softer approach that we have here.
Yeah. More soft. It wasn't always this way, but it's gotten softer. Larry, I see your hand.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I enjoyed your talk very much. One thought and one question. My thought was, that second stage you were talking about after the calm abiding, which is to make inquiry. To engage, or as you said, have a conversation. I find myself doing that a little bit, and I find that the conversations I have is relationship between my mind and all phenomena as I sit. So that's the type of inquiries that I find myself making, and it does put a different flavor on the sitting. So now my question for you is your Dogen quote. It seems to me to bring up the idea of both the relative and the absolute, that a mistake in the conventional is a mistake. And it, from an absolute sense, there are no mistakes. And I don't know if that was the import of what Dogen was saying in that specific regard. It's just the way that it kind of hit me. So I don't know if you...
I think that the key word is trust in that which he uses several times in that statement. We know in the relative sense of things there are mistakes. I made a mistake in Sashin. It was definitely a mistake. But I think he's pointing to big mind, if you will. He's pointing to, kind of all inclusive understanding that doesn't discriminate in quite the same way, even though we're not going to say there are no mistakes.
Thank you, Jim.
Oscar has his hand up.
Oh, Oscar, yeah. Well, I think you're muted, Oscar.
Right. Thank you for that, Paul. I think you really recreated the flavor of Sashin. And thank you, Larry, for your observation about the Dogen quote. I took it as being not different than what either of you said, what you said, Larry, but the part that had juice for me was maybe a mistake was made. Maybe there was a mistake. There are mistakes in the world, but if there's no self-clinging, it's not the same. It's you don't have to carry that mistake. A mistake was made, and a correction can be made now. But it just happened and it's gone now,
No.
Something like that.
The correction is made. The correction is made by, confession and repentance.
That's a real good way. That's a very good way. Yeah.
Just like we chanted chanted in the opening chant.
Melts away the root of transgression.
Yeah.
So I wrote a brief poem. I think it was in my sixth day of my first session, perhaps. Would you like to hear it?
Please.
Thank you. Bell rings. Okay. No bell. Okay. Mind and legs. Same trouble. No problem.
Thank you. Oh, Kenny.
I liked what you were talking about, the 90% of what you think is really not worth dwelling on, and maybe 10% is worth mulling over. I think a lot about TV shows that I've just watched and going over the plot, and I realized, I shouldn't be doing this. This isn't really important. But then every once in a while, a quote from one of our chants will spark something. So I'm open to the 10% that comes in. Thank you.
I didn't quite get the TV show reference, but
no, I just have a lot of junk thoughts that come in and when I'm sitting that are, my mind is just wandering.
Hmm.
Maybe that's not what you meant. About the 90%. So That was what I understood.
Well, I think the 90%, 90% of what, you know, may come up is yeah, not worth giving additional energy to. It's actually, you know, worth just letting go of. And then, but like you have that chant, the line of the chant that suddenly comes, and then that may be worth having a conversation with that line, with that thought. Peter?
I want to speak up for the power of community and the idea of how others that we may sit with or do anything with in my own lifetime, having gone to school with or having run a running race with, whenever I'm with other people, I derive a surprising, I want to even say magical amount of incentive and support to perform better. And so when sitting in Sesshin, you know, I think that we allow ourselves to get subject to greater discomfort, whether for ego or whether for to support the group. It really behooves, I believe, the greater good to do it in community. And I'm personally a little upset and a little self-regretting that I am not able to seemingly show up athletically or artistically or academically presently in the absence of such people. I miss being in a classroom. I miss having a lot of people around doing the same thing. And I want to congratulate all the people who did the Sesshin, albeit in their own, having to do it in their own homes. But I really think that we do get a lot out of doing things together. I think it's surprising how much harder we can push ourselves when others are doing it alongside of us.
Well, you're describing, you know, I talked about the suffering that we're, you know, that is happening in our country, and you're describing a source of suffering that affects each and every one of us, which is our inability to be together and to feed off each other's energy. I mean, this is a tremendous loss that we cannot be in communion, in proximity, practicing together or doing anything together, except, you know, occasionally, you know, we've done some gardening and that sort of thing at the Dharma Center. But other than that, there have been very, you know, few things that have allowed us to commune in the way that you're describing. And that kind of, this is really, I'm very concerned that this is having, you know, what the impact of this is, I think, is very deleterious and contributing to a great deal more suffering that we can't even see or count. So we can only, you know, pray that this is the darkest hour, and it will be for the next several months. And hopefully we will be beginning to, you know, turn the corner and have opportunity to reassert ourselves as social animals, which we absolutely are. We absolutely need each other. This is something I pray for, that we will be back in that situation of communal living, communal being together. Well, thank you very much for your attention tonight. We'll soldier on Zoom, and it's really fun. I don't know what it'll be like on this, but I'm sure it's going to be really fun next week. Always look forward to you know, the contributions that people make for the solstice event. And I think our event next week is actually right on the solstice. So, you know, good vibes, good karma, whatever. we can really be celebrating the longest night next week. So hope to see everybody then.
Mm-hmm.